morning, and thank you all for being here, and thank you to Professor Bragan for the introduction. As she mentioned, I'd like to go over the actual process for how we select our articles. We begin by creating a list of journals from which to select the articles. This list includes the flagship law reviews or journals from each of the top 100 law schools as ranked by U.S. News and World Report. We also include any specialty journals listed in the Environment, Natural Resources, and Land Use subject area of the most recent rankings compiled by the Washington and Lee University School of Law Library. LPAR students then perform a series of steps to filter any articles published by the journals on their list. First, our students identify any article published in the previous year that uses the term environment, environmentalism, environmentalists, and so on. The students then cull the list by eliminating any articles that use the term environment in a manner inconsistent with natural environment. For instance, work environment, political environment, home environment. Once we have identified articles that focus solely on the natural environment, each article is assigned to two students. We assign each article to two students in order to ensure that every article is reviewed thoroughly and not eliminated due to a single student's judgment call. Both students read the articles assigned to them and determine the main subject area of the article. For instance, water or air quality or pollution or climate control. At this step, both students also determine whether the article offers a law or policy relevant proposal that could influence environmental law over the short or long term. If it does, the article goes through another filtering step, where two students again read the article carefully and then ranked it based on criteria such as persuasiveness, feasibility, novelty, or impact. Highly ranked articles move forward, and we continue to filter all the articles until we've reduced our pool to a manageable size, which is not an easy thing to do. And then comes the really fun part, which is debate. The class as a whole reviews all of the articles that remain and spends several weeks arguing which articles are truly the best of the best. And it's very impressive during the stage to see just how passionate students get about their favorite articles. And these discussions can get heated. We eventually choose between a dozen and 20 articles and forward summaries of those articles to members of our advisory committee at the Environmental Law Institute. The advisory committee gives us feedback based on their professional and expertise and experience. With their feedback, we finally pick our top articles for publication. The selection process is rigorous and a lot of work. Before I turn the microphone over to our managing editor, Lorraine Baer, who will discuss the data that we've collected over the past year, I just want to say how impressed I've been with my fellow students' work. They have been dedicated, passionate, and have worked tirelessly towards creating a unique, important, and impressive product that I am honored to have been a part of. Thank you so much to Professors Bragan and Vandenberg, to Narayan Subramanian, and everyone at ELI, and especially to my fellow editors and LPAR students. It's been a pleasure. Now, Lorraine Baer.
Good morning. In 2007, LPAR began collecting data on how many environmental law articles are published each year and what topics the articles cover. Our technology editor, Jay Brock, is primarily in charge of gathering and analyzing this data. During the 2013-2014 review period, 451 environmental law articles were published in top law reviews and environmental law journals. This is an increase of about 12.5% since the 402 articles published in the 2012-2013 cycle. In this review period, governance remains the most common topic. We use governance as a large catch-all category for many subtopics such as administrative, criminal, corporate, and international law. Water was the second most common topic, improving one position from last year. Land use was the third most common category, increasing all the way from seventh place during the last review cycle. Energy was fourth, dropping two positions from its ranking at second last year. However, there were more energy articles this cycle than any of the previous five, continuing an increasing trend. Climate change continued to decline since its peak in 2009-2010, dropping from fourth to fifth. Interestingly, there were fewer articles in purely environmental law journals during this cycle than any of the last five. On the other hand, there were substantially more environmental law articles in general law reviews than any of the other previous cycles. As we continue to collect this data each year, we hope that it provides an empirical snapshot of the environmental legal literature and helps track these trends over time.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jordan Banks. I'm a 3L at Vanderbilt and an articles editor for LPAR. Thank you again for all coming today. We're going to start by discussing Professor Merrill's article, The Shale Oil and Gas Revolution, Hydraulic Fracturing and Water Contamination, a Regulatory Strategy. So first, let me begin by introducing Professor Thomas Merrill, who is the Charles Evans Hughes Professor at Columbia Law School. Professor Merrill is a graduate of Grinnell College and Oxford University, where he was a Rhodes Scholar and earned his JD from the University of Chicago Law School. He then clerked for the Honorable David L. Bazelon in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and the Honorable Harry A. Blackman in the U.S. Supreme Court before joining the Department of Justice as a Deputy Solicitor General. Prior to joining Columbia, he taught at Yale Law School and Northwestern University School of Law. Next to him, we have our first commenter, which is Mr. Bradley Campbell, the principal of Bradley M. Campbell, LLC. Mr. Campbell's firm specializes in legal issues related to energy, the environment, entrepreneurship, and science. Mr. Campbell is a graduate of Amherst College and the University of Chicago Law School. After earning his JD, Mr. Campbell clerked for the Honorable Thomas A. Flannery in the U.S. District Court, D.C., and the Honorable Carl McGowan in the U.S. Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit. Since then, Mr. Campbell has spent time in private practice, serving in the White House Council on Environmental Quality, with the Department of Justice, with the EPA, and as Commissioner of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Next to him, we have Ms. Susan LeGros. She is the President and Executive Director of the Center for Sustainable Shale Development. She is a graduate of Ohio State University and earned her JD from Northwestern University School of Law. Over her career, Ms. LeGros has served as a section chief at the EPA, has worked in corporate legal departments, as executive director of the Mid-Atlantic Solar Energy Industries Association, and in private practice. She joined the CSSD from Stevens and Lee in Philadelphia. And finally, we have Mr. Peter Robertson, who currently serves as senior vice president for corporate affairs at the Pebble Partnership. Mr. Robertson is graduate of the University of Oklahoma and earned his JD from Georgetown University Law Center. Before entering private practice, Mr. Robertson served for more than 6 years in various capacities here on Capitol Hill and later served as the acting deputy administrator and chief of staff of the EPA during the Clinton administration. Before joining the Pebble Partnership, he worked with America's Natural Gas Alliance as the senior vice president of legislative and regulatory affairs. So welcome and you guys can go ahead.
Well, thank you, Jordan, and thanks to the Environmental Law Institute and Vanderbilt for selecting the paper I co-authored with David Schizer to present today and to be honored in this particular fashion. I feel like sort of a puzzled fish who somehow made it past several dams and fish ladders and is now in the spawning ground, has no idea how I managed to get here. But in any event, I do appreciate it. The paper's about how to regulate fracturing. With respect to water contamination, we do address some of the other environmental issues associated with fracturing, but the regulatory proposals focus exclusively on water contamination, although they could also be adopted to some other problems like the risk of seismic activity created by either fracturing or deep well injection of waste fluids from the fracturing process. I don't want to talk too much about the larger picture, but I don't think it would be appropriate to have a discussion about the environmental effects of fracturing and how to regulate them without at least glancing at the bigger picture presented by the fracturing revolution, as we call it in our paper, to provide some context. There's no question, and if you haven't been having a Rip Van Winkle experience the last few years, of course you'll be somewhat aware of this, there's no question but that this particular combination of technologies, hydraulic fracturing, which is pumping fluids into the ground to split apart impermeable rocks that bear hydrocarbons, combined with horizontal drilling, going down and then going out sideways through hard impermeable rock seams, shale seams. But this technological development has been utterly transformational. In the United States, what it's basically done is it's created an entirely new layer of petroleum reserves underneath existing known petroleum reserves, which of course has had the effect of massively increasing the supply of oil and gas in the United States. And as any economist will tell you, when the supply goes up, the prices go down. And so this has had reverberations throughout our economy, and indeed is now affecting the entire world, although the United States at this point is the only country that's engaged in significant amounts of oil and gas fracturing. So obviously it affects consumers. Lower prices for natural gas mean lower heating bills, and lower prices for petroleum products mean lower gasoline prices at the pump. This means more money to spend on other things in the family budget. It affects the economy generally. Consumer confidence is up. Inflationary pressures are further under control because of reduced energy prices. There's been some revival of manufacturing in the United States because lower natural gas prices here than elsewhere in the world. Our balance of payments has improved dramatically. The biggest item in our ongoing deficit in terms of balance of payments was imported oil. That has been reduced very substantially, and so the balance of payments is more favorable. Energy independence is something that every president, since I was politically aware, has been advocating for. Many people thought it was a pipe dream. We're now on the cusp of achieving genuine energy independence because of the fracturing revolution. And lastly, climate policy. It may be somewhat of a surprise to some of you, but fracturing has probably done more than anything else to improve the United States' performance in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. We were able to reduce CO2 emissions over a seven-year period from 2005 to 2012 by 12%, a better performance than any other major industrial country. Some of the credit goes to the recession, unfortunately, and also to fuel economy standards, but probably the largest measure of credit has to go to the increase in natural gas production and the switch from coal burning to gas-powered power plants, reducing CO2 emissions. Now, of course, there are environmental problems. There's a whole long laundry list of potential environmental concerns. Let me just highlight two. I think the environmental community, people who are full-time environmentalists and who care passionately about those issues, are primarily concerned about fracturing because they see it as a threat to renewable energy. And there is something to this. If as the price of natural gas has gone down and the price of petroleum products have gone down, this makes a greater burden on renewables to make their way into the marketplace without extensive subsidies or regulatory mandates. Just as nuclear power is probably on the ropes now because of the fracturing revolution, it's created a headwind for renewables. I don't think that waving a magic wand and eliminating fracturing is going to do much to promote renewables in the intermediate term. I think that getting that technology improved and reducing the costs are probably what's necessary over the long run in that regard. With respect to the public generally, I think the evidence is fairly conclusive that the major concern with fracturing is a kind of sense of alarm about water contamination. And I think there are two simple facts that explain this, that when you sort of explain fracturing to somebody on the street in two sentences, they come away, they hear two things. They hear, first of all, that fracturing involves pumping enormous amounts of fluid into the ground. It includes toxic chemicals, some of which are carcinogenic. And then they hear that this stuff is pumped into the ground and not all of it comes back out. And their conclusion that they reach is, this does not sound good. This sounds like a recipe for some potential water contamination disaster. And I think that sense of concern and alarm is out there as a very potentially potent source of opposition to fracturing or for a demand to regulate it in an extremely harsh and potentially unproductive fashion. So since our article came out, this is a very dynamic and fluid area, obviously. Since our article came out, two interesting regulatory developments have happened. I want to mention them briefly. Last December, the state of New York announced that it was going to adopt an indefinite ban on what it called high-volume hydraulic fracturing, which is defined as fracturing that uses more than 300,000 gallons of fluid in the fracturing process. The rationale for this was a study released by the New York Department of Health, which found unresolved uncertainties about the health effects of high-volume hydraulic fracturing. Interestingly, water contamination was not specifically mentioned. I think the reason for that is that the New York intends to continue to allow, quote, low-volume hydraulic fracturing, which has been going on in New York for some time, and is not going to be banned. But the study was able, with some effort, to gin up some studies that suggest possible health concerns, which would most logically be associated with some type of water contamination issue. The most dramatic thing they could cite was a study indicating that expectant mothers who have babies and who live within a certain distance of fracturing sites have babies have slightly lower birth weight than babies born further away, which was contradicted by another study. But nevertheless, the New York Health Department says this is cause for concern. About 2 weeks ago, another major regulatory event happened. The Bureau of Land Management promulgated its final regulations dealing with hydraulic fracturing on federal public lands and federal mineral estates where there's a split estate between the surface and the federal mineral rights. The BLM takes a very different approach than New York. The BLM adopts very extensive best practices regulations for fracturing on federal public lands. A number of commentators, of course, did urge the BLM to ban fracking, as New York State had done. You have to read this. It's 300-page statement of basis and purpose in the Federal Register. But on page 211 and 212, BLM finally responds to these demands to ban fracking, and the response is as follows. BLM has a responsibility under federal law to act as a steward for the development, conservation, and protection of federal lands by implementing multiple use principles and recognizing, among other values, the nation's need for domestic sources of minerals from public lands. A ban or moratorium would not satisfy BLM's multiple use responsibilities, and regulations can adequately reduce the risks associated with hydraulic fracturing operations. Similarly, hydraulic fracturing operations on Indian lands result in substantial benefits to tribes and individual Indians. By updating the requirements for hydraulic fracturing, this rule protects usable water on Indian lands without a ban or moratorium that could reduce royalty payments and employment. The BLM understands the risks and the environmental impacts of hydraulic fracturing operations, and the BLM believes that those risks and impacts can be managed by the rule. The rule will provide adequate assurance that hydraulic fracturing operations on federal and Indian lands will continue to provide the nation with domestically produced oil and gas, and at the same time protect public lands and trust resources. That was the full response, the back of the hand, to the proposal to ban fracturing. Very different reaction from New York. I would not immediately myself assume that New York's environmental credentials are superior to the BLM's and the Obama administration. And I must say that our own proposal is much more in sympathy with the BLM approach than with the New York approach, although there are aspects of the BLM approach which I personally think don't go far enough. Okay, so on to our proposal. It's rather complicated and, like the introduction said, overly long, 470 footnotes. Our main point, I think, is that we think that the regulatory system that's devised for hydraulic water contamination issues should be a dynamic system. It should be one that seeks to generate new information about water contamination risks and which seeks to generate new regulatory responses to control water contamination risks. it should try to avoid any type of static approach which will stagnate, which might be subject to obsolescence and so on and so forth. So how do we get this sort of dynamic regulatory system? What can we do to sort of tweak the regulatory system so it has this dynamic quality? What we propose is a sort of interaction between best practices regulations, which seems to be what is happening in most places except New York, at the State Oil and Gas Commission level, at the State Environmental Department level, and a liability system that would impose civil liability on oil and gas companies if they do, in fact, engage in conduct that causes water contaminations. Now, so this would provide combined sort of ex-ante regulation, regulation which is in effect in advance of any fracturing activity, with ex-post regulation in the form of liability when something bad is caused by the company's activities. Ex-ante regulation, we think, is good for a number of reasons. The public, as I said, is very apprehensive about fracturing, and the idea that someone has carefully studied industry practices and has imposed, has mandated that the industry have adequately cemented wells, that they have spacing regulations that keep wells away from sensitive facilities and areas, that they have a thoughtful approach to containing the fluid when it comes back out of the well, that they have a plan for disposing of the waste in a proper fashion. All these things, I think, will be reassuring to the public and will help tamp down a potential movement to overly restrict fracturing, depriving us of the various benefits I described out of public apprehensions about water contamination. I think industry would also appreciate best practices regulations because it provides certainty about what it is that they have to do in order to achieve regulatory compliance. Any type of ex post regulation or any kind of highly case-specific regulation like NEPA on the federal lands is likely to generate lots of uncertainty. People in the industry can't know exactly what the costs are going to be. They don't know whether they can afford to go forward or not. And best practices regulations also provide that kind of stability and certainty. That being said, we also think that a realistic prospect of liability is an important ingredient here. Industry doesn't like to hear this. They would just assume not have any liability at all, of course. But I think, and it's not clear that there will be liability. If everybody does the right thing, follows the best practices regulations, there's not a lot of evidence at this point that there is going to be any massive water contamination problem. We've been fracturing in conventional vertical wells for many decades without significant water contamination problems. And the new high volume fracturing in shale is, it has more volume of water, so that's different. But on the other hand, it's also at a lower level, typically 5,000 to 10,000 feet underground. And so there are different ways of predicting that it will or will not be worse than conventional hydraulic fracturing. But there's some reason to believe that it won't be a major problem. But we think some realistic concern about liability is important in the corporate calculus. Now, what type of liability system should we have? We think the most important thing here is how to establish causation. You could have strict liability or you could have negligence for hydraulic fracturing injuries, and it wouldn't make a lot of difference because in either case you'd have to prove causation. And if you can't prove causation, then it's going to be very difficult for people to bring lawsuits, even if they think that their water was contaminated by some kind of fracturing operation. And so we have some very specific suggestions for regulatory tweaks to the best practices regimes, which we think would help alleviate the causation issue if and when liability becomes a realistic prospect. And the two things that we are most convinced are needed are, first of all, baseline testing of water quality before fracturing starts. In other words, wells in the neighborhood would be tested, or perhaps special testing wells would be sunk to determine what the water quality in the aquifers in the area before fracturing is undertaken. Then if an alleged problem is asserted later on, you could do testing later on, compare the quality of the water after fracturing to the quality of the water before fracturing, and that would raise some inferences about the causation of the problem. If you don't have baseline testing and somebody claims that their well's been poisoned, it could be caused by all sorts of different things besides fracturing, and the causation problem becomes extremely difficult. In this regard, I'm disappointed that the BLM regulations do not require baseline testing on federal public lands. BLM thinks that there are various legal reasons why that's inconvenient or difficult for BLM to require, but I think that was a big mistake. Secondly, we think that full disclosure of the chemicals used in fracturing is important. Again, if somebody claims that their water is contaminated by a particular chemical, it turns out that in fact this chemical either was or was not in the fracturing fluid that's being used nearby, that is very probative of causation. If the chemical in the well was not used in the fracturing, then that absolves the company. If it was in there, then that raises a potential inference of causation. So we would insist on disclosure of chemicals, and quite a number of states have gone in this direction, several states, and there's also a voluntary program called Frac Focus, in which companies, I think the better managed companies, are disclosing their chemicals through this website called Frac Focus. But we think that a sound regulatory regime would mandate that. The main objection to this is trade secrets, and the BLM, again, unfortunately, would allow people to file an affidavit claiming a trade secret and avoid disclosure of certain chemicals or in their fracking fluid. We think that's also a mistake, in large part because we think that disclosure is necessary to create a realistic prospect of a liability regime, which is important in developing a dynamic in this particular area. So causation is the first point. The standard of care that applies, I think, is less important. We actually advocate a negligence standard rather than strict liability. There's been some law review literature that argues for strict liability. The reason we like negligence is that we think that the best practices regime can be integrated into the liability regime in some very interesting ways. If you have a negligence regime, it's harder to do this with strict liability. So, for example, there is this doctrine in negligence called negligence per se, which says that if you are engaged in an activity that causes harm, and you violated a regulatory standard, that that's negligence without further inquiry into the benefits and costs of your activity. And we think that's probably helpful. That would give companies an additional incentive to comply with best practices regulations, knowing that if they don't comply and some harm ensues, they may be stuck with civil liability. A kind of flip side is a doctrine called the regulatory compliance defense. It's not really defense, it's more like a presumption in most states, or at least it's evidence of non-negligence. We would urge a kind of a beefed up version of the regulatory compliance defense, to the effect that if the path of causation is one that is covered by a best practices regulation and the oil and gas company has complied with that regulation, that they would not be found to be negligent. So that would give companies a strong incentive to advocate for best practices regulations, and to comply with those regulations, because it would create a shield against liability if they would happen to have caused some kind of mishap that gives rise to a lawsuit. Finally, what about causation of injury that's not covered by any best practices regulation? I think we would adopt a sort of res ipsa loquitur approach there, which would say that a presumption of negligence would arise, again, if you prove causally that the fracturing caused the harm. And the res ipsa doctrine would be functionally a little bit like strict liability. It would shift the burden to the energy company to prove it was not negligent, which would be difficult to do in many of these cases. So our conception of the liability regime is pretty close to the tort system we have right now, supplemented by these regulatory tweaks on the causation end of things, and supplemented by a little bit of doctrinal refinement on the standard of care. And the rationale for this, again, is to sort of create some realistic concerns about liability, not that we're advocating liability, but the concerns about liability, which we think would then help to make the regulatory system more dynamic. The energy industry would have an vested interest in promoting best practices regulations and complying with best practices regulations. And that would go beyond the incentives that they would have if they simply have best practices regulations alone. Many of these state commissions and the BLM, I'm afraid, too, don't have adequate resources to enforce these regulations. So liability is an important part of the picture there. I suspect my time is running up. But you had so many introductions, you know.
Wonderful, Carson. I wish we had so much more time. I
And I don't have time to talk about who should implement these, but we can do that in the Q&A.
Good morning. First of all, thank you to ELI and Vanderbilt for including me today. I was a little daunted because, like many people who start their legal career with a judicial clerkship, I adored my judge, Carl McGowan on the D.C. Circuit. He, in turn, adored Tom Merrill. So my first thought when I saw that I was to comment on an article of Professor Merrill's was, I hope his co-author comes to deliver it, and then I'll feel a little bit freer in my criticism. But fortunately, I think there's some terrific ideas in it, as well as some areas where I would part company with the outline that Professor Merrill just gave. And at the outset, I should probably say that I don't dispute Professor Merrill's opening premise that more oil and gas production is generally a social good. For reasons ranging from the U.S. balance of payments to the many Eastern European states that are at the mercy of Russia turning off the gas pipe, there are enormous benefits. But there are also enormous costs, and the level of what I would consider under-regulation of hydraulic fracturing in many areas of the country has meant that many of those costs have been externalized. And it has tended to obscure the nature of our energy system. There's a popular mindset, oh, that solar and wind renewables generally need to be subsidized, whereas fossil fuels do not. And from my point of view, if you allow externalization of costs, whether it's in the form of carbon dioxide emissions or water pollution, we are collectively subsidizing fossil fuel production and use. And that may be an appropriate thing, but it should be something that's eliminated, that the externalities should be eliminated wherever possible, because oil and gas production is only good if it's done in a way that internalizes its costs and results in allocative efficiency of our resources. I'm not among those who think that prohibitions or moratoria are appropriate for hydraulic fracturing, but I do think that we need more, and as Professor Merrill says, more transparent and predictable regulation. That said, some of the ideas presented in I think the same is true for disclosure of chemicals, although there I think the public controversy is being a little bit over. It is the fact that even if all of the water you inject in the context of hydraulic fracturing, even if all that water met current drinking water standards, had no additives, it would still be the case as a geochemical fact that the produced water that comes out after fracturing would contain carcinogens, arsenic, radioactive material, and so forth. And so what goes in is much less important than the nature of what comes out and how it's treated thereafter. And I think in some ways, the issue of disclosing what goes in is overblown distraction from the real issues presented by hydraulic fracturing. So, there we have it. We're in full agreement so far. Best practices regimes I'm a little bit more skeptical about, frankly, in part because I think that they're often not as dynamic as I think your article suggests. And I also think there's a certain agencies are tied up in terms of how they deal with best practices currently. If an agency deems something a best practice, then they're going to be immediately tied up with, oh, you should have made that determination through some comment rulemaking, and then we're back to the basis with traditional regulation, which in many ways I would agree is not sufficiently dynamic. Any number of challenges in the field right now, but certainly not hydraulic fracturing. A second concern I have is why should best practices be dispositive of liability? as between the homeowner whose groundwater has been contaminated and the company who, in fairness, followed all the best practices. If in fact those DNA tracers show, or chemical tracers show, that it's that driller's responsibility, why would you say that the homeowner should be aware of the costs of that contamination? Maybe that it provides more certainty for the driller, but it also, I think, does not comport either with notions of who the best risk avoider is, allocative efficiency, or even fundamental fairness as between the two potential risk bearers in that situation. So I have some skepticism on that front. And I also have some skepticism about the extent to which agencies may not be as aggressive, and companies may not be as aggressive as keeping best practices at pace with the level of technological development. And I would commend, for those of you who are fans of best practice regulation, I would commend to your attention an article in this week's New Yorker, which looks not specifically at hydraulic fracturing, but at deep well underground injection of produced water from wells. There, Oklahoma has followed a best practices regime, and yet, despite the fact that there are dozens upon dozens of articles identifying the significant increase of earthquake activity in Oklahoma with deep well injection, it remains the case that the state of Oklahoma does not even acknowledge the linkage between the two, and their most recent best management practice regulations do not have any provisions to look at potential seismic impacts when locating new deep well injection facilities, which are also needed for hydraulic fracturing. So I come to the whole best practices debate with a healthy degree of skepticism, and would really think that a strict liability, if you have those tools that Professor Merrill identified in place, where you know whose gas it is, you know whose responsibility is, I think those are cases where there shouldn't be a defense. I also think, just as a pure practical matter, best practice regulation is problematic in the context of hydraulic fracturing. The risk of groundwater contamination, hydraulic fracturing, is predominantly one of failed well cases. The ability ex post for someone to prove or disprove that in actually building the weld casing, best practice were followed, to me is an evidentiary nightmare after the fact to prove that one way or the other. It is to me, that's the hardest part of the hydraulic fracturing regulatory dilemma. How do you get at that very technical issue in a way that leads to better compliance, protects those who may be impacted, but also doesn't stymie development of the resource altogether? And this is not a this is not what environmentalists consider. This is not the result of New York State's pseudoscience on fracking or environmental group screeds about well casings. The industry itself has a very well-developed record going back dozens of years showing that well casing failure is an enormous problem. Frankly, what that sort of is a natural bridge to who should regulate it. Frankly, I don't think there's any expertise at the, I think there's very limited expertise at the federal level on those types of technical issues. And frankly, it's very uneven among states. There are states that are very familiar with the upstream part of oil and gas production because they've historically had a lot of it. There are all other states that either don't have that experience or haven't had it at this level of magnitude in a long, long time, like Pennsylvania. And so the engineering expertise, the drilling expertise, often does not yet reside at sufficient agencies. I do think that that's problematic, whichever hat you're wearing. specifically, other than the water withdrawals. So even in this little corner of the world, the quarter of the country, you've got this completely inconsistent patchwork of regulation, and probably conforms to what Professor Merrill described as the risks of under-regulation and over-regulation. And it largely tracks the political landscape in many ways. And I don't know that, while I would agree with Professor Merrill's conclusion that in the end, probably the states are the place where this should be regulated, and I agree with that also as a former state environmental commissioner, I do think there needs to be either some sort of federal baseline or the interorum effect of possibly federal regulation to raise the general level of regulation and create some greater public confidence that there's at least some consistency among the states, and the worst of the states is at least at a reasonably protective level, because I don't think we have that today, and it has really lent itself to the absolutists who want a moratorium on all fracking and are happy to surrender the benefits of more oil and gas production because they're able to point to the failures in other states. Two quick additional points. One is many of these drilling operations are limited liability companies or special purpose entities. I know we're going to talk about insurance later, but I'm completely on board with Professor Merrill's emphasis that on the need for insurance mechanisms to bolster any liability regime, because a liability regime is largely empty if the responsible entities don't have any assets. And the second issue that I would add for everyone's consideration is the issue of mitigation. Certain of the impacts of drilling, just as is the case in other coal production that affects wetlands, some of them are going to be irreversible, irretrievable losses, whether of water quantity, water quality, opportunities, natural impacts. And I think there hasn't been enough discussion about the extent of those externalities when they're unavoidable, and when they're, in some sense, desirable from a larger social perspective, how and when they should be mitigated. So with that, I think I'll also pass my time.
Thank you, Brad.
Wow. With just the two speakers we've had, I think we could have a debate all afternoon. I also want to thank you for inviting me, and I guess I want to say greetings from the Marcellus. I'm one of the people who's really on the front line of much of this debate that we're talking about here. As was explained, I am the executive director of a group called the Center for Sustainable Shale Development. It's a very young group. It's about 4 years old. And it is a consortium of player extraction and production companies and environmental groups who recognize the need for there to be some type of collaborative discussion and a forum to bring together individuals and companies who thought that it is necessary to collaboratively identify a way forward in order to the benefits that Professor Merrill talked about concerning shale gas development, but do that in a way that safeguards individual rights as well as human health and the environment. Let me just give you a little overview of what our group consists of. We have at this time four large E&P companies: Shell, Chevron, which obviously are international in scope, and CONSOL and EQT, which are more regional companies that own many, many acres and many, many trillion cubic feet of gas resources. EQT is also both an upstream and a midstream company. In addition, we have several environmental groups who work with us. One is the Environmental Defense Defense Fund, which obviously is international in scope. I think it's got over a million members and 500 staff, so it's quite large. The Clean Air Task Force, based in Boston, and with an obvious emphasis on clean air, and they also work internationally. And then a couple of regional Pennsylvania-based groups, one called Penn Future and another called Pennsylvania Environmental Council. And we even have a local Pittsburgh-based group called, and I think you'll like this one, GASP, the Group Against Smog and Pollution. So you can see we have different sides of the spectrum represented. And a major part of what the group is about is the collaborative process to talk about science and bring together the different points of view. And I can assure you that that is not always an easy conversation, but everyone in the group is really committed to collaboration as a means to reach an appropriate area. I do want to say that I think there are some elements of Professor Merrill's proposal that our members would dramatically disagree on in terms of things like strict liability. And so I'm not really going to... I'm not really going to comment on that, but I think there are many elements in the paper that the group would agree on. Obviously, we don't lobby for particular legislative positions, but we do advocate the process of science, this conversation, and collaboration. So let me give you a couple thoughts about where I think the group stands. Number one, we agree wholeheartedly on the need for a clear regulatory system that's based on best management practices. And in fact, what we have done is articulated 15 performance standards that cover what we consider the greatest areas of risk, water being one of them, and air emissions. And those standards are not meant to be aspirational. There are many best management practices schemes out there, and I heard Brad mention some misgivings about whether best management practices really covers the distance that needs to be covered. Certainly there are various groups that have promulgated best practices, and they range from what I would call purely aspirational, we will do our best to limit emissions, to some that are quite specific. We like to think that ours are specific. And in fact, they address certain areas that align very closely with some of the recommendations in the paper. For instance, baseline testing. Our standards require baseline testing before a well is drilled. And a written report prepared on what the results of that are. In addition, we require post-drilling testing for at least a year after closure. And we require disclosure of that information. In addition to promulgating best performance standards, we run a certification program so that companies who are willing to meet the higher standards, and we will be able to show conformance with that and then manifest to the public their commitment to higher standards. One of the statements in the paper that certainly resonated with me was contained very early on, and it says, in addition, talking about what needs to happen, the public must believe, and believe is in italics, that shale drilling is safe. I think that's one of the largest challenges that we have, and certainly that's one of the challenges that the paper attempts to address. How do we put in place a regulatory scheme that will give the public the confidence that this can be carried out safely? And I think many of the recommendations in the paper go to that. But I think a really important approach that is touched on in the paper, but that I'd like to elaborate on, is the role of voluntary standards for industry. There are many who have criticized the notion of voluntary standards if those standards are going to be used as a substitute for regulation. And I want to be clear that the participants in CSSD are not advocating industry voluntary standards in lieu of regulation. A given is the absolute need for a strong strong enforcement, as Brad has pointed out, in order to set a baseline for expectations for extraction and production activity. But even with that baseline, it is often possible to do far better than that. We've talked about the delays and the divisiveness inherent in the regulatory process, and that in some ways puts constraints on the ability to promulgate the best management practices. But people who are participating in the industry, and this industry that has driven engineering and technology to the point where it is today and where it can go even further, are very knowledgeable about what current best operating practices are. And they should be at the table to articulate what they are, and we should be willing to listen to them. I'm not advocating that they necessarily have a free hand, and that is why the participation of environmental groups in that conversation is so very critical. A good example of how that process works is a project that we recently undertook. As I indicated, we have 15 performance standards that are intended to represent steps above and beyond what the regulatory standards in the states in the Appalachian Basin require. And recently we confronted the issue of how to deal with produced water, the water that Brad was referring to. Our original standard allowed produced water to be recycled or to go to underground injection, but it did not allow any kind of treatment. Again, technology has driven the demand for treatment processes such that there are currently a number of centralized waste treatment facilities that are being permitted by the states to treat produced water and flow back water. And the question that was posed to us was, should we, as part of our standards, allow our certified companies to send water to these kinds of facilities? It took us 11 months of very prolonged and difficult conversation and negotiation with consultants from across the board to try to define a safe way where this might be able to happen, recognizing that it was happening already. The states were issuing permits to these kinds of facilities. And more troubling, our standards address what the producers do. They don't necessarily address what their subcontractors do or their or third-party vendors. Although I will modify that to some extent. Subcontractors working on the sites are covered by our standards, and the producers are held to require their subcontractors to meet our standards. But in any event, I think we took some lessons from some of the kinds of things that the article addresses. Number one, what we decided to do was require a very high level of due diligence from producers in selecting and utilizing a centralized waste treatment plant. It's not sufficient that that plant simply have a permit from the state, but that the producer must take a very close look at what that facility is doing, what its permit requires, is its permit does its permit adequately address some of the kinds of constituents that are in produced water that are not typically addressed by effluent limitations and Safe Drinking Water Act requirements? So a strong due diligence approach, somewhat reminiscent of what producers of hazardous waste found themselves trying to do under RCRA in terms of making sure that their waste, when they sent it to a facility, that the facilities had the capability and the management systems in place to be able to handle the waste. So that was one of the approaches that was agreed upon by everyone as reasonable. Another was testing. Before you send your waste to a facility, one of these facilities, you must test your waste and make sure that the facility has the capability of treating it. And then we also required that before one of our certified companies could use one of these facilities, they had to do effluent testing on the waste coming out of the facilities. And this required a high level of cooperation because the waste treatment facilities did not necessarily have to agree to allow this kind of testing. But but we required initial testing, and we're requiring ongoing testing every 6 months. We also require whole effluent toxicity testing, which goes, again, in many ways beyond what the states are requiring. So those are some of the kinds of ideas that I think can be brought to the table by a combined effort of industry and environmental groups that helps drive best management practices. It's our hope that by identifying these best management practices that exceed what the regulatory baseline requires, will allow the states to have specific experience and specific data that they can turn to and use that for driving their own regulatory baseline to a higher level. Just a couple quick comments. There's been a mention of FRAC Focus as a voluntary group. Many states require that the information that information on what the constituents of fracking fluid must be submitted to the state, and then that is also reported to FRAC Focus. FRAC Focus is a somewhat imperfect platform, although they recently announced they're going to be working on improving that. But I think that's really an important step to have some kind of independent, neutral group that is reporting on this information. One might ask, and we've actually had conversations with the FRAC Focus as to whether they would expand the scope of what they're reporting beyond just the constituents of fracking fluid, but to the other kinds of materials that might be used downhole. Again, it may not be all that critical in terms of the substance, but I think the optics and the willingness to report that information can be very meaningful in building public confidence. So I want to make that point. I also want to make the point that there are a number of reasons why industry ought to participate in this kind of an effort. One of them is pointed out in the paper where it talks about the fact that the entire industry, which is going to be here for a long time, they hope, has a great stake in making sure that the lowest common denominator is brought up to an acceptable level, and that some type of dramatic, consequential event doesn't take place that could tar the entire industry. So that's certainly an excellent reason. But another reason is that given the regulatory uncertainty, the fact that you have multiple states, and I believe hydraulic fracturing is taking place in something like 36 states, the fact that you have multiple states, it seems to make sense that if industry can set a standard that is in fact at least as stringent and hopefully more stringent than what the states are requiring, that gives them a lot of regulatory certainty that they say they need and want. Also, this type of approach is a backstop against the fact that administrative agencies have changes in personnel, changes in administration, budgetary cuts, personnel cuts, those create a great deal of uncertainty in the confidence that anyone can have in the underlying regulatory program. So again, a strong industry program, perhaps along the lines of responsible care that is used in the chemical industry, could make a significant difference in building the level of public confidence. And finally, I want to point out that I think this type of an approach allows the industry a certain amount of flexibility. And in the same way that the states can be looked on as, I think you used the term Brandeisian, the states are laboratories for different kinds of approaches. This kind of collaborative approach, which can be adapted in just about any basin to address different types of geologic and hydrogeologic concerns, different kinds of atmospheric conditions within the basin, does allow the industry the kind of flexibility that they often say they want, but allows also a maximization of opportunities to try new things and serve as a laboratory, if you will, for further advancement. I think I best cut my remarks there.
I feel very much like a fifth team here. I'm not sure that anything I say will add much to the very good points that Brad and then Sue made. So I'll just try to offer some random observations about this, but they all spring from the fundamental position that the proposals that Professor Merrill and Dean Schizer have outlined in their paper represent a really terrific starting point, a very thoughtful proposal that deserves equally thoughtful consideration by states all across the country as they seek either to adopt or to revise regulatory and liability proposals. Obviously, my observations will come from my varied experiences in the environmental arena. I worked for EPA for 6 years and still believe as strongly in its mission today as I did then. I also worked for Natural Gas Trade Association for the independent natural gas producers, the companies that produce most of the natural gas that's being produced in the United States. I'm also the yellowest dog of a yellow dog Democrat, and I desperately want renewable resources to succeed and to become a much more significant part of our energy equation. That's not going to happen as quickly as I and a lot of folks would want it to. We're going to be continuing to burn fossil fuels for the foreseeable future, and I want us to burn the cleanest of those fossil fuels, natural gas, to the greatest extent possible. And I want us to get that gas out of the ground in the most sustainable way possible. And I really think that what Professor Merrill has proposed is just a terrific starting point to allow states and environmental groups and all the stakeholders to come together to discuss that and to make progress on that goal. I certainly believe, as I think everybody on this panel has, that the natural shale gas revolution, the shale revolution, oil and gas, has been a good thing, and that any efforts to create a regulatory or a liability scheme should do so in a way that doesn't kill this extraordinary engine of economic growth. And I certainly agree and think generally that Professor Merrill's proposals, as I say, are well suited to allow the continuing vibrancy of the oil and gas industry. But Professor Merrill noted so far that there's very little evidence that fracking contaminates groundwater, especially the fracking activity itself, as compared to surface spills or inappropriate handling of wastewaters, is a likely source of groundwater contamination. And let me also say up front, to the degree that my remarks make me sound like the industry shill that I used to be, that's not Professor Merrill also noted that the public has to believe that shale drilling is safe, or the shale revolution could be vulnerable to regulatory overkill. For me, this is one of the most important parts, because I believe that we're, in many areas, dangerously close to a point now where entire communities believe that fracking and drilling isn't safe and can't be made safe. My sense when I worked at ANGA, and it hasn't abated any since that time, is that our national debate about fracking has been dangerously close to a fact-free debate. We're seeing the consequences of that today. All of the panel mentioned municipalities around the country are seeking to ban fracking and natural gas development generally within their borders. Several states have adopted the years-long moratorium that that folks spoke about. You know, the great state of Vermont has, even before New York acted, has banned hydraulic fracturing. Not perhaps as courageous. Neither will many states have the resources to update their regulations to keep pace with technology. So there's going to be a gap there, and I think we have to think very hard about ways to fill the gap. And I think one important way to do that, as Sue noted, is that relying on voluntary best industry programs is one way, not the only way, but one way to help fill those gaps. Those programs can typically be adopted more quickly and at less societal cost than regulations can, and you get results sooner, which is what I care about. I'm not naive. I recognize the public skepticism about using such efforts as compared to legally binding laws and regulations. And I don't think those programs are obviously useful for developing liability regimes necessary to Professor Merrill's proposals. It's not a perfect solution, and I know how suspicious people would be at using voluntary programs to supplement regulatory ones, unless and until they have a better understanding of the genuine risks of hydraulic fracturing and natural gas development generally, and how best industry practices can ameliorate those risks. I think Professor Merrill's suggestion that the regulatory locus should be at the state level is absolutely key to ensuring that we can move forward on adopting such programs. Despite what Brad said, I think any effort to make EPA sort of the baseline regulator or the lead regulator of fracking and shale gas development is doomed to fail. Though again, I strongly believe in EPA's mission. It would require statutory changes that simply aren't going to be made given the politics surrounding environmental regulation these days. And those politics aren't going to change anytime in the foreseeable future. In addition, the argument that states are better situated to regulate the industry is, in my view, well taken. To cite the rationale that I heard and used most often when I was working for the industry, differences in geology among states with shale gas suggest that a uniform federal regulation isn't really the best way to proceed. I think Professor Merrill is right when he observes that the shale revolution could be at risk from regulatory overkill. The industry's moves away from dry gas to liquid-rich plays, from gas to oil, reduction in rig counts, all point to the industry being particularly sensitive to cost factors. And with gas substantially below $3 a million BTU now and for some time to come, that sensitivity to cost, including regulatory costs, will continue. Excessive regulation will almost certainly dampen gas development or push production into areas where there are less protective environmental regimes, something that I think ultimately we want to avoid. I especially endorse Professor Merrill's suggestion that disclosure should play an important, albeit secondary, role in his proposed structure. I think disclosure can go a long way to help address the skepticism that so many feel about the industry. It's an important part of that education component that I described earlier. I take some of my lessons from disclosure on the success that we had in the Clinton administration in expanding the toxic release inventory program. The TRI program educated individuals and communities and allowed them to work successfully, sometimes with industry, sometimes against industry, in achieving reductions in toxic pollutant loadings. Given that one important voluntary tool already exists for the natural gas industry, frac focus is supergen, and that many states have or are adopting their own disclosure programs, there's every reason to ensure that this sort of disclosure program becomes universal and absolutely required. I similarly endorse Professor Merrill's preference for ex-ante regulation where the risks are not novel or heterogeneous. I don't need to remind people in this room of the axiom of environmental policy that pollution prevention is almost always cheaper and easier than remediation. I'll close with an observation about the politics that I think will surround any effort to adopt such regulatory liability regimes. To put it mildly, it will not be easy. The industry as a whole will certainly fight it, especially proposals that impose strict liability or something close to it. I think it likely that some environmental groups would oppose the proposal that Professor Merrill has put out as not going far enough. The industry will say that sufficient programs already exist, that additional regulation would risk crippling it. I think many of them also genuinely believe that no additional regulation is necessary because the risk simply doesn't justify it. When I first started working for ANGA, it was in the early days of efforts to require disclosure of the contents of fracking fluid. And as I observed and was involved in internal discussions among industry participants, it became clear to me that my thinking about disclosure was very different than theirs. I saw disclosure requirements as ultimately helping the industry, probably even necessary to its survival. I also saw disclosure requirements as inevitable. They were the headlight of a train that was bearing down on the industry, and I hoped that they would get aboard and try to shape those requirements. at that early time, many of them simply dismissed the need for disclosure, saying it's impossible for a properly constructed well to contaminate groundwater. The amount of toxic constituents in fracking fluids is incredibly small. We have to disclose the contents to medical staff if there's any human exposure. There really isn't anything for the public to be worried about. Why should we have to take on the burden of additional disclosure? As a continuing fan of the industry, I won't call it naivete, but I don't have a different word for it. They thought that a properly educated public would understand that there was no risk and therefore disclosure wasn't necessary. Now, to be fair, the industry ultimately did get on board with disclosure, but I fear that same instinctive reaction and a significant contribution of their massive resources against further regulation is what's likely in store. It suggests that we've got a lot of hard work ahead of us to create an atmosphere where regulatory bodies, the industry, and the public can come together and create additional regulatory regimes that will help us ensure we have a robust oil and gas industry for the foreseeable future. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to sneak in here because what we had wanted to do was combine the Q&A and the dialogue on the next article as well. And I know I saw you taking notes. I know you would love a chance to respond. I know that you would all like to continue this discussion. What I'm going to ask, if you don't mind, just trying to be respectful of our speakers for this afternoon and attendees for the afternoon panels, if you guys wouldn't mind taking a brief break and let's introduce Professor Dana's article and those commenters, and then we're going to ask you to come back up here for the discussion, and then we'll have a chance to respond during that. Please join me, though, in thanking them in the interim. So if the next panel will come up, and because we are running behind, I just encourage you to take a break. If you need to take a break, there's coffee in the back of the room, and we're just going to continue to move forward.